With Chime's secure credit card, you can start improving your credit scores with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments. Get started at chime.com/build.
The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Results may vary. See chime.com for details. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
Welcome to Cloudy with a Chance of Podcast. I'm Chief Meteorologist McCall Bride-Ags with my co-host, Meteorologist Kirsty Zantini. As always, we are so excited for you to join us, whether you're listening or watching. We have both audio and video versions of our podcast now. But let's get right to our guest today because we're really excited to have her on. I've known this person for a couple of years now, and I can't wait to hear about what she has done for the Weather Service and where she is now and what she really has goals for the future. So let's head over to Kirsty. So you can introduce our guest today.
Yes, not to get our names confused, but our guest is Kristen Cassidy, and she is with the National Weather Service office in Wilmington, Ohio. That's why McCall and I know her so well. We talk a lot about the partnership that broadcast meteorologists have with the Weather Service Department and offices across the country. And Kristen is a huge resource to us here in Dayton, Ohio. And so we want to say hi, Kristen. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. Welcome.
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much, McCall and Kirsty, for inviting me to be a part of this podcast today.
I can't believe we've waited so long, Kirsty.
I know, which is crazy because, Kristen, we've seen you many times. We've talked to you many times during weather chat and severe weather instances. And, you know, it's a shame it took us this long to get you on the podcast.
Hey, well, I'm happy to be here. And again, thank you so much for this opportunity to not only talk about what the Weather Service is doing, but also some of the exciting upcoming changes we have in our products and services.
That's wonderful. Well, let's start off with a little bit about you, Kristen. How did you get to the National Weather Service? McCall and I talk with our guests a lot about the different paths people take to becoming meteorologists and maybe when the weather bug first bit you. So what's your story?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for those of you who don't know, I actually grew up down in the Cincinnati area. And I was always one of those kids that love to go outside and look at clouds. Particularly, I love snow. You know, what kid doesn't love snow? They want a snow day, right? But I'd go outside and just sit in the snow. You know, pull up a foldable chair and just watch it. I was always so fascinated with the weather, and it was kind of always something that I knew I wanted to do, and I really never wanted to do anything else. And so that's kind of a blessing because I know a lot of people kind of, you know, they spend a number of years trying to figure out what it is that they want to do. I was really never in that case. So I got my bachelor's of science in meteorology from St. Louis University. I knew I wanted a little bit smaller program. There are, of course, a number of local programs, which are very, very good programs. But I was looking for something a little bit smaller. So St. Louis University, their program is very small. In fact, there were only four other meteorology majors that graduated with me in my class. So yeah, it was kind of fun because each of the courses was more of a discussion opposed to a traditional lecture. And then I went out and got my master's in meteorology from University of Oklahoma. And of course, that's one of the more well-known meteorology schools, just because of the amount of research that goes on out there. There are great partnerships, not only between the education sector, but the government sector as well, and the private sector. It really is a fantastic operation they have down there, where all kind of three sectors of weather come together to protect lives and property. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what everyone's kind of aiming for.
That's awesome. I mean, first of all, I love women in science. So, kudos to you and
thank you.
That amazing path, and to show all the little girls and, you know, maybe teenage girls that are looking to take a path to say, you can do it too. It's not just a man's job. And that points to what you said about in college that, you know, there were only a few women, you know, opposed to all the men. And I had the same experience when I went and got my bachelor's degree. There were just three of us in the class and the rest were all men. So it's nice to know that, there's more of us out there, and hopefully we'll get that balance a little bit more as we move forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I think we're already starting to see it. We do a number of outreach and collaborative things with different local programs. And you certainly see that equality is evolving in a lot of the programs. You're starting to see many more women, which is great, because again, it's one of those things that we want to be able to prove that, hey, we can do it just the same as anyone else. And so it's really important for us to stress women in STEM. It's great to see.
Yeah. So how did you get then with the National Weather Service after you finished your master's? I know that there's like levels, right, in terms of what office you're placed in, and then you kind of, so why don't, for people that maybe don't understand how the National Weather Service works, why don't you explain a little bit, if you are just starting off in the Weather Service, what's your title and like how does it go and how do you even get a job?
Yes, absolutely. So for those of you who may not be aware, most federal jobs are posted through a website called USA Jobs. And that pertains particularly, of course, to National Weather Service and NOAA positions as well. And so you go on to usajobs.gov, you build your profile, upload your resume. And essentially, I kept checking the website to see if there were job postings, job openings. I had some great guidance from several meteorologists who were already in the Weather Service. So I kind of knew what to look for, and they gave me some guidance along the way for the process. So when a job will come out, oftentimes there are only certain offices that will actually have an entry-level vacancy. And so you essentially apply for the job, and then you can, through the course of the application package, indicate what office you would prefer. And you can kind of rank your offices in preference. Now, it doesn't always happen that you get your number one office. In fact, I would say that that's pretty rare. Yeah. I was fortunate enough to get my number one office. I wanted to work for my hometown office in Wilmington, Ohio, of course, serving the Miami Valley area, the Cincinnati Tri-State, and then also up into Columbus. So I was very fortunate. I'm kind of one of the few that actually got to where I wanted to be at the entry-level position. And, mm-hmm. and as you mentioned, you have the opportunity, once you're in that entry-level position, to kind of move up once you gain years of experience. The first year is a lot of training, particularly with issuing warnings, as that is kind of the number one thing that we do, particularly convective warnings. Uh-huh. So there's a training program that's hundreds of hours long, and it culminates in a training out in Oklahoma where they actually put you through simulations and you issue warnings in this simulated environment, and they kind of throw everything at you.
Oh my, that's crazy!
What you're able to do, yeah.
That seems rather intense. I didn't know that part about your job, which, I don't know, Kirstie and I have test anxiety, so I'm glad I didn't have to go through something like that. Once school's over, I just put that in the past. Speaking about warnings, I think that kind of pivots to one of the big questions that Kirstie and I had. Recently, there has been a change to the severe warnings, and I wanted to know if you could explain that a little bit better for our listeners and watchers.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Weather Service just implemented something called impact-based severe thunderstorm warnings. That's been implemented for tornado warnings for several years now. But essentially, it allows us to assign a kind of a threat category for severe thunderstorm warnings. And much like you get notifications on your phone for a tornado warning or flash flood warnings, now you will get notifications on your phone through wireless emergency alerts, or WEA, for severe thunderstorm warnings, which we assign a destructive category to it. There are several reasons behind this. Number one, we recognize that severe thunderstorms, particularly those producing at least 80 mile per hour winds or baseball sized hail, they represent a significantly higher threat to the public than even the base warning, which would be 58 miles per hour or a quarter-sized hail. A little bit of background on that. During the derecho of 2012,
yeah,
that hit Central Ohio, parts of the Miami Valley, West Central Ohio, with 80, 90, 100 mile per hour winds, we really didn't have a way to message and communicate to the public that this was an extra level of danger for a severe thunderstorm. But now we have that capability, and we have the ability to activate phones, which is very important because we understand that a lot of people do carry their phones with them and may not be necessarily attached to a radio or a TV or some sort of other source. But now we can get that information directly to those who would be most impacted.
Now, go ahead, Kirsty. Oh,
real quick, actually. So, personal story, my older sister was hiking with her two little kids up in Cleveland, and I think it was probably the first time Cleveland had issued the destructive severe thunderstorm warning, and she got that alert and ran to their car and was able to get safely in their car, and then they were able to safely avoid that line because it was a very intense severe thunderstorm. It was a strong line of storms that went through the Cleveland area. Right. And yeah, that just recently happened. And she was like distraught. She was texting me like, what is this warning? And I was like, actually, and it used the EAS to alert her, not, you know, she didn't have a weather app or anything. It used that emergency alert system, which again is key because it doesn't have to just be a tornado that, you know, 80 mile per hour winds that would be just as strong. So, yeah, so there was some success there in my family.
And I would, that kind of is the next question that I was going to ask, and you sort of answered it, Kirsty, in your story there, is for some clarification, this new change in the warning is not just on the local level, but nationally. So even if you live outside of the Miami Valley and you were to go somewhere else, that type of warning will still be issued.
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. This is a national change that has been implemented, and Kirsty, your story, that's exactly why this change was implemented, because some people may not have an app that sends them severe thunderstorm warnings, that would alert them, but this will, because we recognize the 80 mile per hour winds, those are the kind of winds that you would expect in a potentially lower end tornado, and so we want to make sure that with 80 mile per hour winds, the damage potential is exponentially higher than would be the case for the base 58 mile per hour wind warning. So this is a national thing. We have not issued at Wilmington a destructive tag yet. We hope that that's far in the distance. Yeah.
We can take a break for a few more years.
But you know, we know sooner or later that's going to be needed. And this is just a way for us to alert those and get that information in the hands of those that need it the most.
Now, as we are transitioning from severe weather to winter season, and still on the same topic of impact-based changes to warnings and watches, something that was a change a couple of years ago that I don't think has been used perhaps in our viewing area, Kirsty, is the snow squall warning. And maybe you can talk a little bit about that in case that's something that might get issued this winter season.
Yeah, absolutely. So snow squall warnings, we have issued a couple throughout the past several years. I don't know specifically whether they've been in the Miami Valley area or not, but research has shown that the greatest number of injuries and fatalities oftentimes are not during the bigger winter storms where, say, you're expecting 5 to 8 inches of snow, because people generally will avoid travel or they'll alter their plans so they're not out on the road. The best way to think of a snow squall is essentially a thunderstorm with snow. It may not have thunder, it could have thunder, but we want to try to avoid the large pileups that oftentimes result from snow squalls. So we have started issuing snow squall warnings to alert drivers of whiteout conditions. Essentially momentary blizzard conditions. You can go from nothing, it looks perfectly fine, to essentially not being able to see 100 feet in front of you. And of course, if you're driving on a highway, especially in an interstate, you're going 60 miles per hour and all of a sudden you can't see 100 feet in front of you, that's obviously a big concern. So the snow squall warnings will activate the wireless emergency alerts on your phone as well. And hopefully, and the other thing too is they will actually activate ODOT, select ODOT electronic
right.
signs. Mm-hmm. So, but of course, those signs are mainly on the interstates, but the activation of WEA will be no matter where you are.
Now, when it comes to issuing warnings, when you're talking about severe weather, you use radar. Obviously, you can see if there's a hook developing, or you can see the intensity of winds. That helps you to issue the severe products. I imagine the snow squall warning is a little bit more difficult to kind of pick those out, because when you look at a snow squall situation and stuff like we have in the Miami Valley, you have snow showers all over. How do you determine which one is going to get that warning? Is it a lot more based on visual reports, or maybe you could explain more on that?
Sure. Well, it's a combination of the radar presentation, as well as we're constantly monitoring webcams. Yeah. ODOT has a variety of webcams that we can monitor. And of course, reports that come in from our spotters. The other neat thing is we can also monitor road temperature conditions, because that plays a big role too. Sometimes you can have snow showers that resemble a snow squall, but if your road temperatures are well above freezing, then we would probably not issue a snow squall warning. But for example, if your road temperatures are right around freezing, that's a big difference. So we kind of take all of that information into account when we're issuing the warning. So as you mentioned, McCall, it's not just the radar presentation. It's kind of a combination of that with webcams and road temperatures to decide when one would be needed to be issued.
So this is, you kind of just brought this up when you said spotters, which again, I typically just associate the spotter network for severe weather. Is that something that's new with the snow squalls, or have you utilized your spotter network in the winter time in the past? And I just probably never really realized that.
Some of our most recent training that we've done with our spotters has included a little bit of information about snow squalls.
Okay.
Because of course there is a technical definition. You need the wind, you need the drop in visibility, you need kind of a rapid accumulation of snow, even if it is just a half an inch. If that half an inch falls in 5 minutes, that's going to be an issue. So it wasn't part of the training several years ago for our spotters, which we typically will do late winter into early spring. That's typically when we have our spotter training courses, and those will probably start to be announced here as we head into the early parts of winter in terms of our schedule for next year. But we try to rely on our spotters not only during the summer, but then the winter as well, and also give us snow reports. For example, those 5 to 8 inch storms that we sometimes get, we like to hear from our spotters and like to get their official reports as well after the snow has come to an end.
Our trained spotters are fantastic here. Yeah. You guys do a great training program. I don't think that you necessarily were able to do it to the extent that you have in the past because of the pandemic, but maybe you can tell our listeners and watchers about when you typically hold these events and what does that mean that you could be, 12 years old, or you can be 55 and be a spotter.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great point, McCall. We kind of had to adjust our typical spotter program the past couple of years. It used to be where we would travel to many of the counties and have an in-person course. But we've kind of pivoted to a little bit more of a virtual platform. In the past couple of years, we've conducted virtual spotter training courses. And we've had hundreds of people attend these, all ages, like you said, kids, adults, those just looking for a refresher. Maybe they took an in-person course mm-hmm. several years ago. These courses are typically about 2 hours in length, and they run from generally late winter. I'd say we start in February, and then it runs typically through about early April. We haven't yet determined this year whether we will be able to resume in-person courses, but this is a way for the public to help the National Weather Service, because we rely on these trained storm spotters. We kind of give them information for identifying what the difference is between a wall cloud and a shelf cloud, because of course, those are things in severe weather that are very important for us at the Weather Service to get a sense of what's actually happening out there. You know, our office is just in Wilmington, so we kind of have an army of spotters throughout the area that are kind of our eyes on the sky during these severe weather events.
I would also say, even if you're not a trained spotter and say you take a picture of a cloud that might look interesting or threatening, there is a way to get you that photo. There's an email, correct?
Absolutely. We have a spotter email. You can send it to our office email as well, right, which is we call it our webmaster account, but also on Facebook or Twitter. We're constantly looking for pictures and reports on our social media platform. McCall, you're so great at forwarding us some of the pictures and photos that are forwarded to you. So that's really where a lot of our partnership comes in as well, because we want to know if there's damage somewhere. We want to know if there's a funnel cloud somewhere. I know a couple of days ago, McCall, you had sent us some photos that we had not previously seen of some funnel clouds.
Yes.
They look pretty scary too. I think to the average person that doesn't know what they are. And Kristen, I've been told by your coworkers, you're like the social media guru on the team, if I'm correct.
Well, I try to develop new and better ways for us to communicate to the public, because at the end of the day, we can issue warnings. We can issue the best forecast, the best warnings, but right, if the public is not receiving or interpreting the message in the correct manner, then our mission kind of falls apart a little bit. And so we found that social media is a great platform to be able to kind of dissect a more complicated forecast and really tell the public, our social media audiences, what to expect. And so we have a social media team at our office. We try to develop new and better ways to communicate to the public and get them to take action when it is needed to help protect themselves.
Kristen, because you're kind of talking about, what your office is doing during severe weather, obviously we have a plan, McCall and I do, and Dante, the rest of our team, when we're under severe thunderstorm warnings, we cut in for tornado warnings, we go full coverage, and we have a team that if we have multiple meteorologists there, like McCall will be on the weather wall and Dante may be driving the radar for her. I know that you guys break down your tasks as well during severe weather. So for somebody that might not know the workings, you are the ones that issue severe thunderstorm all warnings. We cannot do that as broadcast meteorologists. We just relay that message. So what is going on during severe thunderstorm? We'll just say a severe thunderstorm warning and maybe a severe storm that could produce a tornado. Mm-hmm. How is your team broken up? What are you guys doing?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kirsty. Ahead of a severe weather event, the shift supervisor will typically assign duties. And your duties are going to be, a primary radar operator. And that's someone who is strictly interrogating radar data. They're not answering phones. They're not doing social media. They really are just using the training that I kind of briefly mentioned, and just looking at radar data, just looking at, not only reflectivity and velocity, but things like correlation coefficient and some of the other derived products to figure out what a storm is going to be doing and try to get that warning out with as much possible time. If the coverage is great enough or the intensity of the storms is great enough, we actually could have two or three radar operators, and that is, again, their sole job. We have someone then that is going to be dedicated to NWS chat, as well as social media and making sure that our messaging is getting out to the public. We will also have a dedicated mesoanalyst, someone who's analyzing observations, the changes in the environment, because that's really, really so important. You can't really figure out what a storm's going to do unless you can correctly identify what type of environment it's working with. That information is relayed directly to the radar operators. And then, of course, we have someone who's, we usually have two or three people answering phones, getting those reports from our spotters, and then maintaining our forecast, because, of course, we issue aviation forecasts and a variety of other things. And we could also have a hydro operator, someone who would be dedicated solely to issuing flood products because you're looking at completely different data to figure out whether, you know, a flash flood warning would be needed opposed to a tornado warning.
So if you are not local to the Miami Valley, in 2019, we had a tornado outbreak. And I know, Kristen, you were working that night. I know that you were not assigned initially to be someone issuing warnings, but as things escalated, your job changed. Briefly, can you tell us about your experience of that night and how it all transitioned and transpired?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I came in that evening, I was assigned to social media and kind of, you know, to answer phones and kind of our messaging specialist, so to speak. But McCall, as you know, the coverage of storms and the severity of storms ended up expanding so quickly that we initially had two radar operators, and that actually turned into five people at one point that evening issuing tornado warnings, because not only the intensity of the storms, but also the coverage. For those of you who may not remember, in Central Ohio that night, we actually had rotating storms in Central Ohio that didn't produce tornadoes, thankfully. So those are, you know, those storms still needed to be watched. And so we kind of sectorized, you know, one of us had the Miami Valley, another had West Central Ohio. And for those of you who haven't seen our operations area, it's very open so that we can communicate very quickly and very openly with each other to make sure that we all know what we're in charge of, what our assigned duty is, and make sure that nothing is missed.
Wow. Now, and after this storm,
kudos, by the way.
Yeah, bravo.
Nothing was. You guys were amazing. Your lead time was fantastic.
Kirstie and I talked about that for weeks. We still, the lead time that you gave people. We only have a few minutes left here, but I just would like you to briefly talk about after the storm. You guys are the ones that are doing the survey, and you're going to, you know, come and tell us the rating and the path length and the width. Mm-hmm. What is the organization and preparation to send people out and things like that?
Absolutely. So one of the first things we will do is we'll get in contact with the county emergency management, because a lot of the reports we know are going to be shared with them. And so we will generally coordinate a time with emergency management personnel from the counties impacted to come out and survey. And what that typically entails is a team of two meteorologists from our office going out to actually document. That means take photos. That means determining, okay, where did the tornado actually first touch down? Where did it lift? What is the width of the path? And of course, a lot of that too, we look at radar data ahead of time to kind of get a general sense of where it may have first touched down. As we always say, and we say this to our spotters, radar data is a tool. It doesn't tell us 100% what is happening or what is not happening. So that's why going out into the field, taking a look at the damage, talking with those impacted by the storms, that's why it's so important. And so typically that will be the process. We'll get in contact with emergency management. We'll kind of set up a plan for where we're going to start the survey, where we're going to end. And then we come back to our office, take a look at all the photos, take a look at the damage. And a lot of too of what we're trying to determine is how strong the winds were within a tornado. And of course, that has a lot to do with construction quality and, you know, a variety of other things, particularly when you're dealing with the weaker tornadoes. You know, had it been really soggy and the ground and the, you know, the trees just toppled because it was a soggy ground. So those are all things that we take into consideration when we determine the maximum wind speed, which will ultimately determine the rating that the tornado will be assigned.
That's amazing. Kirstie, any final questions for you before we wrap up?
Honestly, Kirstie, we got through so much. I think a lot of people like to get that inside look at what you guys are all doing at the Weather Service office, because most people just get the warning and they don't really maybe know all that work that goes into, you know, releasing those warnings, all the training that goes into you being able to issue it. So thanks so much for sharing with us.
Hey, thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of your podcast today. And again, for any listeners or viewers out there, you know, feel free to follow any of our social media accounts, and always feel free to give us a call too. If you have a report of damage that you'd like to make sure it gets in our hands, feel free to give us a call. That's why we're there. We're 24/7 operations. So we're there to serve the public.
And I would echo that because I've met a lot of you at the Weather Service. You're all very kind people. And I know the more information that you have, the better you can do your job. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it can be a couple weeks later and someone says, I had this damage. Well, it's already been a couple of weeks and you may not be able to assess the way you would have liked to had it been the day after an event. So feel free to reach out. Do you happen to know the Twitter handle or the Facebook handle that people can look for?
Yes. So our Twitter handle is NWS, as in National Weather Service, and then the letters ILN. The little backstory to that is there's actually another Wilmington office,
right,
in North Carolina. So we had to get creative with our Twitter handle. But Facebook is just Facebook.com/NWSWilmingtonOH.
Well, thank you so much, Kristen. We'll probably have you on sometime in the future. Maybe if there is some big storm that comes through, we'll need your analysis and everything that happened and experience. As always, thank you for joining us on Cloudy with a Chance of Podcast. You can download, subscribe, and listen to our podcast on your phone, whether it's an Apple or an Android, just use the podcast app. You can also watch this, our video version, I'll post on our YouTube account. Just look for Cloudy with a Chance of Podcast. Also, if you download the WHIO app, if you have a Roku, Amazon Fire, Apple TV, we will also have this video version there, as well as on WHIO.com. That's a mouthful, but we are so happy that you came to hang out with us today, and we'll see you next time.
You can probably treat yourself to an ad-free upgrade or at least grab an extra latte after getting a Chime checking account with features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe, no minimum balance requirements, and no monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/goals24. That's chime.com/goals24. Chime feels like progress. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply.